is.
Welcome to Two Old Farts Talk Sci-Fi. I'm David Klink.
And I am Troy Harkin.
And this is our episode about CISFA, the Canadian Science Fiction and Fantasy Association. And we have a special guest for this episode. Clifford Samuels joins us. But before we get to that...
Well, Dave, I was thinking, because this is an award show, and just last weekend... the Academy Awards happened, and I thought it was pretty cool that there were some big wins for some genre things. Did you actually get a chance to see the Oscars, Dave?
Yeah, I definitely watched it, and I loved the performance of the Ken song, which was a lot of fun.
Yeah. Yeah. Now we'll talk about Poor Things in a second, a little bit, but I thought it was really cool that it was Arnold Schwarzenegger and Danny DeVito who presented the awards for best visual effects, and it was Godzilla Minus One that won the award, and the four person team, the Japanese team, showed up with Godzilla figures and brought them up onto stage to collect their Oscars. I thought that was so sweet and nerdy.
Yeah, and we both love sweet and nerdy, that's for sure.
I know. That should be a chocolate bar. That would be like the biggest genre chocolate bar. Or it should be called genre. It's sweet and nerdy. The amazing thing about Godzilla Minus One winning this award is its budget was $15 million, which is nothing.
What?
$15 million.
That low?
And it beat out everything that had budgets of closer to $300 million. So like Indiana Jones, the recent Indiana Jones film was, I think, $295 million. And some of these other big budget, like the Marvels, it was also in that range. So that's what we're looking at for most big budget films when they put out something with all the CGI and whatnot, but they managed to do it for $15 million. And from everything I hear, it's the best Godzilla movie ever made. And partly because, you know what they did with the money? They put it into the script.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is where it belongs, doesn't it?
That's right. The writers, get some money into the writers' pockets. Poor Things. Let's talk about that just briefly. I think you saw that too as well, right?
Well, I'm afraid I have not, because I wasn't in the mindset, because I heard it was a bit dark. But I heard it was a great film. I will at some point see it when my mind is right.
Well, it is a warped, beautiful little masterpiece based on a novel. So it won. It was nominated for 11 Academy Awards, and it won 4, including Best Actress for Emma Stone, which was well-deserved, and Best Production Design. I was just going to mention a couple of these other films that, you know, genre for a long time didn't get recognized at the Academy Awards. Mm. And so I guess the biggest one ever was Lord of the Rings, the third film, Return of the King, from 2003. And it had the clean sweep of nominated for 11 and won 11, which is insane. And that's the most ever. Like, next, it's tied with Ben-Hur and Titanic.
Wow.
Yeah. Anyway, there are some other notable ones. I don't want to go on too long because it's not the sort of the focus of our show. We're doing awards, but we're talking about writing and Canadian writing and Canadian awards. But I did also want to touch on... we've mentioned this before, how Joker and Dark Knight Returns, we had Best Actor Oscars given for playing the same character, for playing the Joker.
Yes, yes.
And that was Joaquin Phoenix and Heath Ledger. Now, the Joker actually had 11 nominations and 2 wins. Dark Knight Returns had 8 nominations and 2 wins. And other than that, I'm just going to, we talk a lot about Stephen King on our show. There haven't been very many awards for Stephen King films, despite, you know, the fact that there's probably, you know, somewhere between 50 to 100 feature films. But Misery, it's the only one to have won a major Oscar, and that was for Kathy Bates as Annie Wilkes. So that was something. But, you know, other ones that could have been there potentially, Green Mile, 1999, it was nominated for 4 Academy Awards, including Best Picture. Shawshank Redemption, which is now considered one of the best films ever. 1994, it was nominated for 7 Academy Awards, including Best Picture. Stand By Me from 1986 was nominated for Best Adapted Screenplay. But, you know, I think Reiner could have been nominated for Best Director for that film. He also directed Misery. So, yeah, I think things are getting better, though, with genre nods, don't you?
Yeah, definitely with some recent films, with Parasite, with Shape of Water. There have been some genre films. I very much liked Arrival, even though I'm not sure how many it had won. But there have been some very good and very well-received. And I think it took a long time, you know, since things like Star Wars, Star Trek, E.T., and Close Encounters of the Third Kind, which was very much one of the biggest critically acclaimed, and also one that a lot of people loved and watched, that just recently, and with a number of things that are science fiction, fantasy, horror, that are within Netflix, within all of these on demand and these kinds of providers, there's just so many good things out there that, you know, science fiction is and fantasy and horror have reached the highest heights I think it's ever reached.
Yeah, and they also drive box office. So, you know, why not throw some love out to these films? Now, I went back to check out 2001 because I was thinking, how is it 2001 did not win Best Film in 1968? And what did it lose to? So I checked it out, and it was the musical Oliver, which is pretty hilarious now, because I think, you know, if you look at what which stood the test of time better, it's got to have been 2001. But 2001 was nominated for 4 Oscars, and including Kubrick for Best Director, and it did win one for Best Visual Effects. Anyway, it's just it's kind of interesting. I'm glad we're going in the right direction. And David, I just thought off the top here, because I don't know if we'll get a chance to later, I would throw in my quick Oscar awards related Beatlesisms.
Okay.
So in the category of best animated short film this year, there was a Beatles winner. The best animated short film was War Is Over, inspired by the music of John and Yoko. It took home the statuette, and Sean Ono Lennon was there to accept the award. And I was also thinking about Yellow Submarine. Was it nominated? But as it turns out, the award for best animated feature film did not exist until this century. So it was not around as a category in 1968 or 69. But Yellow Submarine was nominated for a 1969 Hugo Award.
Well, I got to go and put in a bit of defense for Oliver. Because it was quite amazing at its time. Rather dark film, and let's just say there's not everyone makes it till the end without giving away too much. But it was certainly one of those films that sort of, as a musical, really changed things. Things like West Side Story also. And was it Gigi? And Cabaret and a few other, like, there have been a number of great sort of musicals that have really changed or made a difference.
Should we remember to actually just get on with the show?
We are recording this session via Zoom. In the interests of transparency, I am on the KISFA board that Clifford is on, and I have known Clifford for a very long time. But I don't think Troy and Clifford, I think you guys, this is the first time you've met, right?
That's right. I mean, at least in this timeline, I don't think we've met, but you never know.
There may be some parallel Earth where you both have been the closest of friends for 40 years.
Yeah.
It's possible. Here's a bit about our guest. Clifford Samuels has been collecting science fiction and fantasy books for over 40 years. It can be said that even if he stopped buying new books, he would never be able to read what he has. But that will never happen. He has founded, chaired, and run numerous genre conventions in Alberta. He was on the board for Calgary's When Words Collide Festival as guest liaison for 12 years. As a board member of CISFA, which is the Canadian Science Fiction and Fantasy Association, he has held the positions of president, media liaison, and treasurer. But for the past 14 years, he has administered the Aurora Awards. Welcome, Clifford.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Glad to have you.
Just off the top, is it okay if we call you Cliff or should we just go with Clifford?
Cliff is just fine. No need to be formal.
Okay. Two Old Farts Talk Sci-Fi is a look back to when we fell in love with a speculative genre, to recall these times with fondness and affection. I like to start episodes with a quote, and here's a quote for the show. From the Wikipedia entry on Canadian science fiction. A strong element in contemporary Canadian culture is rich, diverse, thoughtful, and witty science fiction. We like to ask our first-time guests their earliest genre memories, loves, and their all-time faves. Cliff, what was your first speculative genre memory?
It would have to be TV or movies, and I was thinking about that the other day, and my favorite memory of science fiction was when I saw Forbidden Planet. And the movie came out when I was just when I was born, but I saw it in repeats in the theater and on TV. And I think that drove my love of the genre. And of course, I'd read comic books and things like that, and I loved them. But I didn't really start reading science fiction until quite late. So I'm kind of a late bloomer in that respect.
Thanks a lot, Cliff. I think we both love that film. It's a classic, that's for sure.
Yeah.
What genre comics were you reading at the time?
A lot of Marvel. I love things like Thor and Spider-Man and things like that. But there were also things like the Greek legends and stuff like that would be coming out. And of course, I had a nice box, and I think I moved to Calgary way back when, and eventually that box never saw it again. So it's so many of us have lost our childhood comics because, you know, your parents take over they want space and they say, well, he's not here. He doesn't want these. He never took them. I took my books, but the comics, unfortunately, didn't make it here.
Mm. That does hurt.
So, Cliff, what was the first speculative genre thing that you actually fell in love with and why?
Well, I had an English teacher in grade 10, I guess it was, and he really wanted, you know, he knew I liked science fiction, but I hadn't really found anything that jumped out at me. I really wasn't a reader, which is kind of strange for people who know me now. And he recommended two books, and Stranger in a Strange Land and Dune. And I started Dune, couldn't really get into it because of the language. But then I read Stranger in a Strange Land, and I think that was the first time I'd actually found books that hadn't been forced on me by teachers. Because I always find if I'm given something and said, you must read it, I don't want to read it. If I find something that I want to read and it interests me, then I can get right into it. I did eventually get back into Dune and whipped right through, and then found authors like Clifford Simak and Larry Niven and so many others.
Thanks a lot, Cliff. We would like to get into your all-time genre faves. Here are some rapid fire questions about your favorite genre things. We are just looking for titles, but if you feel the urge, you can expand a bit. You might have a fun story to tell. So, but we do wish to get to talk about Kiss for soon. Troy will ask these questions. Take it away, Troy.
Okay, Cliff. So who is your favorite genre author?
Yeah, with my thousands of books to try to pick one child.
Yes, Sophie's choice.
Yeah. That's a really almost an impossible one. I would probably say for some of his work, Jack L. Chalker, his Midnight at the Well of Souls book. And I can get into that later.
Okay, so in the same sort of vein, what is your favorite genre novel?
And that would be, it's a series of novels, but the first one is Midnight at the Well of Souls by Jack Chalker. I have a math degree, and one of the things this book, the idea of the book was the universe is built on a series of mathematical equations. You alter the equation, you alter reality. And it was a mystery novel as well as a interesting science novel with lots of really cool aliens.
Okay, let's
go. That sparked my love of it.
Let's go from novels and shrink it down a bit and go to shorter work like novellas and short stories.
I don't read a lot of short stories. I mean, some of Larry Niven's Known Space novellas and short stories are some of my favorite, but I found Del Rey books came out with a series of best of authors, and for me those were amazing. Robert Silverberg did the Science Fiction Hall of Fame, which has probably more of the best shorter works that you will find from older authors.
We're moving on to the cinema. What's your favorite genre movie?
Okay, I'm going to split this one into two. For science fiction, I go with Galaxy Quest.
Oh, sweet.
And for my fantasy one, Princess Bride.
Oh.
I saw that pre-release at a NASFIC in Phoenix. And I was with artist Ken Macklin and author Frank Robinson, author of, he did Inferno, which became Towering Inferno. And we sat in an old Spanish theater and watched this movie, and it was amazing. But the movie wasn't coming out for 2 months, and I could not tell my wife. And I actually held the secret for 2 months, which is how I think now I became very good at running the Aurora Awards, because I can keep a secret when everybody else is trying to get the who won. I can keep my mouth shut. I won't.
You know, at the so in the opening of the show, when we were talking about Oscar related genre films, past and present, I touched on a couple of Stephen King films that could have been nominated. And so two of them were Rob Reiner films. Well, one of them did win, which was Misery. And Stand By Me was the other one that I had in mind. But yeah, Princess Bride, so good with Reiner. And that's Goldman, right, who wrote the script and the book?
Yeah, I mean, I could rewatch that movie over and over again. Whenever it's on, it's sort of like, even if I watch 10 minutes of it, it just brings back wonderful memories. And I mean, the same with Galaxy Quest. The humor and the story were so well done. And a lot of these movies, I always wish they would never, ever remake them or do a sequel. They're perfect as is.
Yeah. And this is actually a bit of a surprise for David as well. I was talking to Ira Naiman this week, David, and I was pitched the idea of how at some point in the future we need to do a Galaxy Quest show. Like, it just needs to be done, and he is probably a great guy to have it. But yeah, it's such a good film, and I love was it Brent Spiner who said that this is a film that we should have made?
Well, that movie inspired a group of us to do a Galaxy Quest costume contest entries into a costume contest. And we all dressed up as characters from the show. My wife did Grednik, and she actually was in stilts. And at the end of the costume. We won, of course. We actually made a costume for the MC who put it on as he was doing the introductions. And we actually had to come down a flight of stairs into where the stage was, which was very interesting with somebody on stilts.
Yes.
But after we all got taken as a group photo, and a friend of ours who had been to the site where the battle with Grednyak and Tim Allen's character were fighting, he actually superimposed us onto that background. And my wife had always said that the costume she made, the colors weren't quite right. Well, she blended into the background, and people actually did not, they couldn't sometimes see her. She faded into the rock work. So we all know that her colors for the choice that she got for the quick, cheap material was dead on.
That's so good. Okay, let's move on to your favorite genre TV show.
Oh, I mean, I love so many. Babylon 5 probably is one of my favorites because of the continuous story and the complexity of, I mean, I love Star Trek. I love, you know, all of those, but Babylon 5 just was such groundbreaking stories. And you go back and you see things in the background later, which was amazing.
Now, this does not have to come from Babylon 5, but can you give us your favorite individual all-time genre TV episode?
Blink, Doctor Who.
There you go. Well, you definitely did not have to think about that one too much.
Oh, no. Oh, I didn't have to blink on that one at all. That one was, it stayed with you. And I think that's what was so powerful about that. I mean, the episode with Frank Gorshin in Star Trek where half white, half black, I mean, that would have been the second one, which also stuck with me because it was such a meaningful and it dealt with such a strong topic and so well.
That's also one of my favorite Spock moments, because every so often Spock throws you for a loop, and he was there on the bridge saying, you know, I don't see the difference. You're half black and half white. So Spock somehow didn't even notice that one of the guys was black on the right side versus white on the right side. So even he could not even see that, but maybe that's because he doesn't see that as a big difference. So that's, I think, an important thing. Maybe I've said too much. But anyways, on the KISFA, Troy usually does the history, but I will be doing this for this episode. I'll give some background, set it in context just a bit. But what I've done, and maybe this isn't the right thing to do, is I actually went to the KISFA site, which is csffa.ca. I went to the website and looked up information on the organization. And I'll just read part of what the organization is about from the site. So this is about the Canadian Science Fiction and Fantasy Association, or CSFFA. Since 1980, KISFA. Since 1980, Canadian Science Fiction and Fantasy Association, CSFFA or KISFA, members have recognized both the best Canadian SF and F professional writing and the best Canadian fan activity. The KISFA Volunteer Board of Directors organized Aurora Awards, are Canada's national science fiction and fantasy awards. Additionally, a KISFA Volunteer Board member coordinates annually a Hall of Fame jury. From a list of nominees, each jury chooses the newest members of the KISFA Hall of Fame. In 2011, KISFA became a federally registered nonprofit society. Annual KISFA membership open to all Canadians is $10, and the KISFA annual general meeting occurs online. So that's what's said online. But I was wondering, Cliff, I do appreciate all the work that has gone into the revamping of the website. A lot of good work has gone into it, and it's looking great. But it is also a work in progress. And I was just wondering if there's any part of the history of the organization that you may wish to speak to that is perhaps missing in the description, like who was the people that sort of were the driving force and just how many times it sort of changed.
The KISFA is an interesting society because it didn't start out as a society. It started out as people in Halcon in 1980, the two organizing gentlemen deciding that they wanted to give a lifetime achievement award to A.E. Van Vogt. So they came out and they did this wonderful award. They had a beautiful trophy made. And then the following year, nobody actually expected to do it again. So it missed a year. And then somebody said, you know, we should continue this. And if there was no society, there wasn't anything. They gave one item. So the following year, time they did it, they gave some more. And then over the years, items kept getting added. Best novel, shorter fiction, fan activities. Eventually, we morphed and got, we actually had a point, had a dozen categories. And at some points, we've said, you know, this category doesn't work. We had visual presentations, which was movies and stuff, and there just isn't enough. And so we dropped that, and we've amalgamated things where we used to do one just for fan organizing for conferences, but there's less conferences now. But at the beginning, the awards were being run by one or two people behind the scenes getting the lists going, but each convention would run their own awards ceremony, and they would figure out who won based on voting, and they would have to come up with their own trophies. So trophies varied for quite a number of years until about the late 90s when Frank Johnson came up with this gorgeous metal, deadly, pokey trophy that people have lost clothing to in their luggage. Mm. And we always had to wrap them up extraordinarily well to mail them because they were metal pieces that were bent with cutout maple leaves in them. They were gorgeous. The awards were given out that way for about 25 years until Frank retired. And then we decided to create our own. I came up with the logo design that we're currently using. And it's based on a pin that we started giving out, that was about 2010, I think that was the first year we gave out pins. The idea came from John Mansfield and his wife, Linda Ross Mansfield. They had a fellow in Montreal design us a pin, and that stylized logo has stayed with the society of a maple leaf and a sort of the pointy bits that were based on Frank's design ever since. So we've morphed, the trophies keep changing. I've had to rebuy new designs since manufacturers changed their design. We had a beautiful glass and stone one for years until the manufacturer just up and stopped making them. And we had to find new ones. So now in about 2008, the society took over the managing of all aspects of the awards. And we've morphed. We added things like an eligibility list online. It used to be that people would send in their selections and we'd have to figure out from that. So now people can see what is eligible. And now all aspects of the awards are online, including our AGM. So I think being online is the way to go. With the last conferences, we actually find that it's easier. People don't have to travel. Mm. And as David, you mentioned, our website is a work in progress, because if somebody sees something that needs adding or changing or it doesn't quite work, we're always looking for advice.
Cliff, can you please tell us how you were first introduced to KISFA and genre awards in general?
One of the earlier recollections, I didn't have a lot of in the early days, but in 91, my wife was managing the Aurora Awards for the conference we were running in Calgary. And so I got to see all aspects and how the voting went and all of that kind of thing. But it wasn't until about 2007 when Clint Budd was trying to create it as an official society and asked me to be on the new board that I took a much closer look at it. Because before it was just a matter of, well, when the ballots come out, I'll go and I'll vote, maybe. But now we've got much more of an official thing. And Clint really wanted people from across the country to be on the board, so we got a true Canadian perspective.
I was wondering if we can just get into, because the three things I want to mainly talk about are KISFA itself, the Aurora Awards, and the Hall of Fame. So the first part is just KISFA. And we've already talked a bit about its beginning, some of its changes, and so on. We've talked a bit about the website. But I was wondering if you can talk to people about, again, the cost, how to join, and sort of just an overall sense of what it is, why people should actually join this if you're interested in it.
Absolutely. No, I mean, KISFA is there for both creators and for readers. A lot of the awards are based on what people have read, what they've enjoyed, and that's really our focus. And so we're really pushing to get more of people who read science fiction. It's not just for somebody who writes science fiction. It's, I personally, because I'm a reader, I'm not a writer, tried it, not happening. But KISFA was actually really simple to join, and it's not that expensive. For $10, you get an annual membership to the society. So that runs from January to December. Our online process is so simple. It's, you go in, if you want to pay, you can pay via PayPal. If you don't have PayPal, it has a credit card option. So you can go in and put your money in and it'll run your credit card. It's the easiest way. That way we don't have to be running to banks. Yes, there are fees that come off from things like PayPal, but it's makes the society more flexible, and our people can, anybody from anywhere in Canada can participate. The society, the website is pretty straightforward. It has lots of good links to tell you what is there. The website has a lot of information. It has rules, which I think is great. And I think if you are a reader, one of the huge benefits is that, you know, you might say, well, I don't know what's good and what came out. How can I vote? We have a voters package that we've arranged with all of the finalists, and we get pretty well everything that was written or links to it, things like the artwork, that you can read or look at and get an idea of, I like that more than this. You can read all the short stories, all the poetry, all the novellas. You can go after the fan work. You can go after the anthologies or magazines. We usually get most of those, and including some of the novels and the young adult novels. So if you're not familiar with some of the stuff, we'll either have the entire novel either as an EPUB or a PDF. And if you don't have it all, we'll have a chunk of it so you can get an idea if you like it. This way, when you vote smart. You vote with the understanding that I read every poem and this one's my favorite. And we have a ranking system for the voting where you vote for your first, second, third, fourth, and fifth positions in the voting. And we encourage you to put that, because if your first place vote isn't one of the top ones, your second might be, or your third. And that way, if you really love something, you don't have to worry about that, oh, well, I have to vote for the other one because I don't like this other one. You rank them, and then you tell us what those rankings are. And the voting system is literally you drag and drop information into a sort order and say, yep, that looks good, I'm done. And the nomination process is drop-down lists, and you select the item. So we tell you, based on our eligibility list that people have put in that we've verified, that I like these poems or these short stories, but we only ask that you do it if you know it. Vote for what you know, nominate what you know.
Yeah, I think and we've almost stretched into the Aurora Awards a bit, but go ahead, Troy.
I just wanted to ask, Cliff, can non-Canadians vote or what?
It's open to all Canadian citizens, whether they live in Canada or they're expats. Plus, it's also open to landed immigrants. So if you are a landed immigrant, you've lived here long enough to get your landed immigrant status, you are also allowed to be part of the society.
And I guess permanent resident or whatever the terms are.
Or permanent residence. It keeps changing on me.
KISFA, I guess, as its own organization, runs the Aurora Awards. And I wanted to get more into the Aurora Awards, but you've already mentioned a bit about nomination and voting. I guess with nomination, there is a way of entering, whether you're the person that produced the work or whatever, it's generally better for that person to do it because then you know that it did come out that specific year. But I think it's looked at for the specific year, like this year, for the nomination's already closed for this year.
Well, nominations are nominations close. Yeah, nominations closed on April the 6th. That's right. And but the thing is, we get a lot of the publishers, the magazines, putting in the works because they know what's reprinted and what's not. Mm. And then in May, we will be announcing the top five in all the categories that are there and who have gotten the most votes. And of course, when we're talking what I'm doing the English language side of the Auroras. Because when we started, we actually had a Francophone side as well. And that's been passed off to the to a separate group that runs it in Quebec, and it's being hosted through the Boreal Awards. And they actually call those the Aurora Boreal. Is very Canadian.
Yeah, I would. Yes, absolutely. I was getting confused for a minute by the difference between making something eligible and putting them into a database. And then there's three levels. There's getting the stuff onto the site of
That's
saying
correct.
That these are works. Then there's a point which you're right. It did open up recently, the actual nomination period, which will be closing, I guess, in early April
April. Yeah. And then the job is that I go through the top people and figure out how to get a hold of everybody and let them know that they're on the ballot and confirm that it is an original work because something gets reprinted. Just because it's reprinted doesn't matter. One of the key things, of course, we had to change over the decades is that we get a lot of audio works now. And so if something is an electronic, it's only been published online, or it's in print, or it's in audio, that would be your first print. So if a book or a story is published as an audio book or story, whatever year that is the year it's eligible. If the physical printed book comes out the next year, that is not eligible. That actually is a reprint of the audio. And we do get people who have taken short fiction and expanded it into a novel. And that's an original work because a significant portion has changed. Mm. So it's always fun for us to go through on the eligibility to determine what is there, what isn't there. Translated works are not defined. Those are not novels. Those are what we call a related work because it's the translator, not the author, who is being up for an award. Because a word can be published in Japanese or it can be published in French, but the translated work might come out the next year. And that translation is what is eligible. So how good a job did the translator do to create that? Similar to what an editor does for a magazine. How good a job did they do in publishing that magazine? It's not the actual stories. It's the magazine's quality.
A lot of the stuff that we've covered in the Aurora Awards, we've already discussed. Just a couple things. In some cases, I think our podcast, you know, this small little thing that Troy and I do happens to be up in one of the categories. I'm not sure if we're even allowed to say that, because people have to be aware of the entire thing before nominating or voting on it. But I think ours got moved. And in some cases, you have to move stuff around because, for example, something might be fan related instead of fan other, for example.
That's correct. Well, related actually is other. We have fan writing and we have fan other. And somebody sometimes has put some podcasts into the writing portion, but it's not a written thing. This, in a sense, it's an audio event, very much like going to a reading or to a convention or to a concert similar to the music concerts, the film concerts out there. Those would be fan related. If you're up for something that you've written, when you're writing a magazine, we have a number of magazines out there like Polar Boreal, which is a unpaid work by the editor. He doesn't get paid for it, though his authors do. So his authors, because they're paid, are in the professional side of the category, but he himself is in the fan side because he doesn't make any money. He actually sponsors it and pays these people. So it's one of those things you got to figure out where everybody fits in the scheme of things.
One thing was, because I know a decision was made, and I think it was a good decision, just because the Aurora Awards for many years was connected to a convention. In fact, conventions sometimes bid or tried to make a case that they wanted to do the best job of hosting the Aurora Awards, and that went on. But there just aren't as many conventions anymore. They either move around or aren't run anymore. And I think the decision was made to have it as an online event. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, in the beginning, the awards were, well, technically, as I mentioned earlier, run by each of the host conventions. Eventually, when KISFA took over things, the convention would host it. They would have an award, a beautiful, in some cases, wonderful award ceremony. But of course, it's only there when the people who are physically there. And of course, these things were never recorded. They were never broadcast. So if you had the money and could travel to that conference, it was great. But it was a great time that you could meet people and, you know, honor them at that time. We've had conventions. We did one in Halifax near the end of our live ones. It was great. They put out the most amazing food spread. They had a great site for it. Unfortunately, there was too many things going on at the same time, and we had almost nobody show up other than the nominees. They did a good job, but people just didn't, they don't think they were aware of what was going on. But as you alluded to, David, there's fewer and fewer conventions going on in Canada. Volunteerism is getting to be more and more of a problem. So we decided a number of years ago that we were going to do it as an online convention. Our host, Mark Leslie Lefebvre, and his wife, Liz Anderson, have done an amazing job. They've made it a lot of fun. They've made it accessible to everybody. And you can be anywhere in the world and be part of it. We had some people who intended to be part of it, but it was so late in the day. I think they were in Italy and on holidays during the event and weren't able to. But we've hosted it in so many wonderful cities. I mean, from Ottawa to Toronto, and Vancouver, Edmonton, Winnipeg, Halifax. I've got to travel all over the place, but it does become expensive for people.
Yeah, one of my favorite moments or memories, I won one Aurora Award for a poem I wrote for Alexa, a love poem. and I won it in 2013. I didn't attend the convention, and Rob, my brother-in-law, Rob Sawyer, was the one accepting it on my behalf. He actually called me from the podium on his cell phone and got me to be able to address or talk to the audience to thank them and to thank the Aurora Awards and everything else. I thought that was kind of a nice moment there, but we don't have to worry about that as much now that it's online and one can just enter, join the session and be there.
Yes, and we get a lot of people. It becomes more of a news item where people are taking the information and putting it onto their Facebook pages or whatever, and they're doing it live, which is quite a lot of fun to see.
One thing I wanted to ask you about is just we do appreciate just trying to keep on top of the awards and just make sure that there isn't anything funny going on, like what's happened in with the Hugo Awards, with the sad puppies, and with other things that have happened with other award shows, and even recently what went on at the China World Con, the Chengdu, is that I was wondering if, without, you know, naming names and without getting into super detail, what are the kinds of things that you've noticed or found that people perhaps shouldn't do when it comes to the awards?
We've heard stories over the years. We've had stories, and they actually happened, but we've heard stories of people having voting parties in their house, and they have a computer where everybody gets on and they vote. And what we've always asked people to do is, voting is personal. This is something you personally need to do. The same with nominations. And you should be nominating what you know. We also try to make sure that the nominees don't try to get all of their aunts and uncles and nephews and to not, if they read science fiction, they're familiar with it, and they're willing to read the other works to say, yeah, I like this, and to do it honestly, then that's a fine. But if they're only going to be voting for you because they're your cousin or your mom and your dad, that's not what the awards are about. The awards are about the best in Canadian science fiction by the Canadian science fiction fans in Canada. And I think that's really what we wanted to stress. It's for fans who read science fiction. We frown heavily on people sending out, here's the slate of what you should be voting. People need to make up their own minds. Yeah. We also tell people that they're not allowed, you know, if you nominate me, I'll give you my short story, next short story. You can't give anything away. And if we find out about it or we see it happening, we either try to shut it down or people get disqualified.
And that's happened a few times, without naming names or specific incidents, where people have been disqualified, or in some cases, they've been asked to remove their name from the award. Otherwise, you would still leave it in because they did reach the number of votes, but you would let people know that.
We've never had anybody removed, thank goodness. We have had some works removed from the ballot. Then we were reading them, they were on the ballot, that it turns out they weren't genre. And just because somebody writes genre works doesn't mean all of their works are genre. And that has, people have to be really careful about that. And then there are cases people let us know that, hey, that one actually is an older story. They just republished it, and we have to do things like that. I think a lot of the times when we look at the works, we really just, we are very forgiving. We're very Canadian, and we've been fortunate. We have not had giant campaigns. I think everybody understands that, and we've been very fortunate.
Yeah, one of the things I've been concerned about, like if someone has an issue or a problem, like just similar with the sad puppies back in with the Hugo Awards, but also years ago, there was something with American Idol. I had heard that some people just didn't like that process of voting and having to try to make someone vote, and you know, there shouldn't be a contest like that. So instead of just not watching, what they did was en masse, a whole bunch of people that felt the same way would vote for whoever they felt was the worst singer in the top 10 or 12 or whatever it was, try to get enough momentum to push the worst singer onward. And I think with Sanjaya, who's sort of a fairly famous person from years ago, was helped up until like position number 7 or so, because there was this large group of people who did not like the awards and just wanted to do that. My answer to that is, if you don't like it, don't watch it, and don't try to muck it up for other people.
Yeah. So, I mean, we've been very fortunate that we've not had campaigns like that. Every time, you know, we have had case way back when it was still paper that we got a stack of votes in the mail and a giant payment, and we looked at it and it had been photocopied, and somebody had, all they had done was signed their name. And there must have been 30 or 40 of these. And we kind of looked at this and says, we're not entering these. These are identical. This is somebody who has trying to manipulate the vote, and they got thrown in the garbage. And
David, oh, sorry.
go ahead. No, sorry, Troy.
Sorry, I'll let you finish that thought though, Clifford, if it's a continuation of that. I
Well,
just wanted, before we got too far away from it, I wanted David to explain for listeners what sad puppies are, because I'm not sure, and I'm sure there are listeners who don't know either. But I'll come back to that. You finish up your thought, okay?
by handing in a stack of votes does not help anybody. And I think David will allude when he talks about things later, is groups that force a slate of votes to come in is not helping anybody. It doesn't come out to show you what is the best. And that is really what these awards are trying to do, is what is the mood of the society right now? Are we interested in one versus another? Do we want more science fiction? Are we tired of fantasy? And those are the things that people were more likely to vote for. So you get that feeling of where it comes from. The nice thing about the Auroras is it's Canadian wide. We track where memberships come in. We don't know what they voted for, but we do know that, let's say, you know, a huge number from BC has been voting. So we know that people are really gung ho over there. And we do know that there are areas in Canada that we need to better promote to get those people, places like in the prairies, places like, you know, Winnipeg and Saskatoon and Regina, and even in the Northwest Territories and the Yukon and Nunavut. We need more people who read the genre from across the country to give us a feel of what they like.
Right. So, David, you've touched on sad puppies a couple of times. Can you explain for our listeners who may not know what you're referring to?
Well, certainly it's something that I don't want to mischaracterize or explain all the stuff that had happened around the groups. People can certainly Google it, but basically, from what I understand, I'm not an expert on this and didn't read a ton about it, is that this was a group, generally, without being, you know, trying to be too specific here or to cast aspersions, but generally this the sense I get from it was there's a number of white males, sort of older white males, who felt that the awards, too many of the awards might have been going to people that weren't, you know, like white males just didn't have a chance to actually win awards anymore.
Okay,
And I think they
gotcha.
cited that. So what they did was, as a large group, they ended up voting for sort of like a slate and said, well, this this is the white male that for novel, this is for this. And they had sort of like a slate and they got so many votes. And because there would be four or five other people on this thing splitting the other votes, they would always win every year. So what had happened was instead of everyone else on the ballot saying, well, we'll decide that this person out of the other four or five will be the person that we'll now all vote for and hope to outvote that other person. They just said, we're going to vote no award. So what had happened was everyone was encouraged to vote no award just to make sure that person who shouldn't get the award would get the award. So there was either a year or two or somewhere in there where there's a whole bunch of no award category. Therefore, no one got the award for those years. And that was basically a group that I think personally, I think I would have just started their own award. If they're not happy with how the awards are going, they should have just simply started their own award and done something different instead of wrecking that, you know, that award. They did something a year or two into it about slates or something that there was something. And again, I'm speaking in general terms. You can easily Google this, but and there's stuff even in Wikipedia about it. And you just have to go to the Hugo Awards, and there's always articles about it. But what they did was they did something to cut down on slates. And there were rules that if they set up a slate, that those books cannot be considered or whatever it is. But again, I'm just speaking in general terms. But I prefer that people not do this. Like, if you don't like an award, start your own award or ignore it. Don't try to muck it up.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks for that, because I wasn't sure if that was an actual term or a subgenre group or something, you know, a phrase I wasn't aware of, like filk or something.
Yeah. And I'm just, again, I don't want to get into trouble or anything like that. And certainly someone who's part of that group could probably speak to it better. And there's probably ways of just Googling and maybe finding out who the people were that were involved in creating that whole group and what their reasoning was behind it and what they did. I'm certainly not trying to cast aspersions or saying what they did was right or wrong. They certainly had some concerns and they did what they did, but it's really up to people to learn more about how that worked themselves. I just, from my own point of view, I would prefer that people not try to do stuff like that, you know, if you're not happy with the system, I mean, I can't really compare this, and this is probably unfair because he's certainly not a sad puppy, but years ago, there was a new award that was created, and I think part of the reason possibly is a concern about maybe the Aurora Awards wasn't doing the things that he wanted. But Peter Hollis started the Sunburst Awards as a juried award, because with the Aurora Awards, it's one where people vote. A juried award is done by a jury.
Right.
And I gave him a lot of props and positives for that, because he actually, instead of wrecking or trying to change or do stuff with the Aurora Award, actually started his own award. I think that's, for me, what maybe the sad puppy should have done. Maybe they did do that. I just haven't followed it.
Well, I guess we should probably get into, actually, rather than people griping, let's get into a celebration of talent and greatness and the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, this is the last part of our episode, is about what one of the things that KISFA does beyond the Aurora Awards is the Hall of Fame. And basically, I guess it started originally, and Clifford, you already mentioned that it was originally for A.E. Van Vogt, a Lifetime Achievement Award. And there were a number of them over the years. I've got it from the Wikipedia page that Susan Wood got a lifetime contribution one in 81, Phyllis Gottlieb in 82. They've gotten a bit confused. They have Judith Merrill twice, but I think it was in 1986, Dennis Mullen, Robert J. Sawyer, and then it became what it is today in 2014, where it became a Hall of Fame. I don't know if you want to speak to that, Clifford.
Sure. Well, I mean, when it first started, the Auroras weren't awards for novels and short stories. They did lifetime achievements. And those people, they originally did A.E. Van Vogt. He was originally from Winnipeg or that area in Manitoba. And they wanted to honor him for his incredible work, and rightly so. Susan was a fan. And the next time, and I don't remember where it was, but the Hall of the lifetime achievements were what they gave out. They gave out a novel award and things like that, but they just did the one lifetime achievement, and that was it. And it lasted for a number of years. We reignited it in 08. We started the Auroras. We wanted to thank Dennis Mullen. Now, Dennis was the gentleman for quite a number of years who ran the Auroras on his own. Now, you look at, we have a committee. This was a man on his own doing everything. He managed all of the voting coming in and got the ballots out and did all that work and helped with each host convention. Which was a huge feat. And then in 2013, when we physically decided we're going to make a trophy to do the Hall of Fame and call it the Hall of Fame rather than a Lifetime Achievement Award, we decided that we were going to, you know, Rob was, he was going to get this gorgeous, we gave him a trophy. And then at that point, we said, we're going to create a physical trophy. And that's why in 2014, 10 years ago, we started inducting people into it. And we decided that everybody who had a lifetime achievement would be inducted that same year. So all of them have their names on the plaque. Well, they have a plaque on the full trophy. And it's quite large and heavy.
Is it we'll be getting lethal?
Oh, no. No, it's well, only if you drop it on your But it's a gorgeous sculpt. The trophy itself was created by, Gideon Hall, I think his name is. I might have it wrong. I apologize if I do. But Gideon created this sculpture. It's a poured lost wax sculpture of two heads, one on back and one on front. The one on one side is a male who is the Green Man, and the other side is a astronaut, sort of a 1960, early 60s style astronaut with the helmet and all of the modern helmets we have today. And it's a young lady. And it's a gorgeous piece of work. It kind of looks like greened metal. And then it sits on a base of mahogany series of levels. And at the moment, we are arranging to get additional levels added to it because we're only got enough for a couple more years. And we do three currently. And originally it was, you know, some years it was two, some years it was three. You lose, you know, there's only so much space on these wooden things.
Yeah.
And it's going to get a bit bigger and a bit heavier. But we, you know, we used to take it around, and David has agreed that it's going to move from my basement to his place in Toronto for a 10th anniversary celebration this year, which is quite a milestone for the Hall of Fame.
Well, you know, in this day and age, and also appropriate to the field that it celebrates, you should make it robotic so that it could actually transport itself from place to place. No, David says no. No.
I don't trust enough of the shipping companies. The amount of packing we have to do, and I have sent it across all over the place. And just as a sideline, I'm quite fortunate. Last year, actually, I was inducted into the Hall of Fame. I wasn't expecting it. I figured once I left the society, they would induct me. And they surprised me last year by letting me know that I was being inducted. But Clint Budd started the whole process. It was his brainchild to do this, and he arranged for the trophy. And we've moved the trophy across the country many a time. But the problem, of course, is now there are fewer and fewer conventions to ship it to.
Right.
Yeah, and I'm looking forward. We haven't settled on the actual date or location or the people attending, which basically means we really haven't settled on anything. But we are going to do a 10th anniversary. I was visiting my brother-in-law, Rob Sawyer's place, and I saw the plaque that said 2014, as this plaque about the Hall of Fame. I thought, well, 2014, this is 2024. That sounds like 10 years. They said there'd be no math, but I thought, why not do a 10th year, 10th anniversary celebration? Now, beyond that, I think we're pretty much near to wrapping up. I just didn't see, I mean, we could talk just a bit about the fact that there are other award shows, but I thought that would probably stay for, because there's just so many out there beyond just the Hugo and the Nebula and the ones for horror and the ones for mystery and all sorts of different things.
Each country has their own. Australia has a science fiction award. It's very common, though. I've been hearing a few actually are not happening because I think volunteerism. They just don't have the people to do the work. It does take a fair bit of work, David knows, to put on the Auroras, to put on the Hall of Fame, to get juries every year. And of course, all the societies are looking for people across their region to give a hand.
Yeah, we've had conventions closed down from that reason, just as the fans get older and they don't continue to do that, and there aren't new people coming in beyond the anime one. There's that Anime North that has close to now 35,000 people attending it. When it started off with a few hundred, then 700, it just kept doubling or tripling every year. It's one of the exceptions. But I remember there was the Toronto Trek, which became Polaris, and then there was Ad Astra that had run. I think Ad Astra ran over 30 years.
Yes,
And
you
there
had
are
Ad
other
Astra
conventions.
and you had SF Ontario. There has been VCon in Vancouver. There is Pure Spec in Edmonton. There has been conventions across, and conventions morph. When Words Collide in Calgary is probably going to be less genre than in the past when more of the genre people were managing it. And that's just things evolve. SF CanCon in Ottawa is one of the few conventions, and you have SF on the Rock in Newfoundland, and you have HalCon, which is a fan-run comic expo. I mean, Calgary has a comic expo. It gets like 100,000 people a year. But comic expos are not literary conventions like, Ad Astra was, or even CanCon is now. They're very different fish.
Well, we've had our listeners refer to KISFA throughout the show. Obviously, they're not reading that; they're just hearing it. So that's CSFFA. And Clifford, what would the website be for KISFA?
It's pretty straightforward too. It's csffa.ca.
Okay, that is super easy. Now, we always ask our guests to if there's anything that or any place they'd like to direct us to, where we can either check out things you're doing or anything you want to sort of point out to us before we wrap up the show.
I think the best place, go to the KISFA website, find out more about the society, sign up. If right, if you're hearing this before April the 6th, then you can sign up and put your nominations in for your favorite works. And voting will begin later, and we will have an award ceremony on August the 12th. Mark Leslie Lefebvre and Liz Anderson will have said they will. I have to confirm, but it sounds like they will host the award ceremony again. They have done an amazing job. They make everybody welcome and they make it a lot of fun. My Don't know what our theme is this year. Last year we had we did older people who have won the award many, many years ago. I think, David, you were one of our introducers.
Yep.
And the introducers have no idea who wins. I'm the only one, and Mark gets sealed envelopes. And he opens the envelope only when we've had the award ceremony. So it's kept totally secret. We don't even send it out as a press release so magazines can get it in their press. I've always felt that the only people who should know are me, and there's no leaks. And then we celebrate all the wonderful people who have won. And it's a fun evening, and we always hope as many people join us.
Absolutely. That is our KISFA episode about the Canadian Science Fiction and Fantasy Association. And thanks a lot, Cliff, for being our guest.
Oh, thank you.
It's great. Great to meet up here, Cliff.
It does. It's nice finally to meet you, Troy. So this has been great. And if people do have questions, we do have links where you can go in and put in questions to the society.
Well, I'm heading to the website basically as soon as we wrap up here. And speaking of websites, please, you can check out our website, which is 2numeric2of.ca. And we would love it also if you joined us on Facebook, which is Two Old Farts Talk Sci-Fi. That's all language, no numerals. And just continue to listen, please. Tell a friend, let them know that you're enjoying the show. Like and subscribe if you have those options. And we would really appreciate that.
Yeah, that worked out very well. Thanks a lot. I'm David Klink.
And I'm Troy Harkin.
See you all for our next episode of Two Old Farts
Talk Sci-Fi.
What did we do before Google? That's the question.
Oh, I know. And we should Google that. What did we do before Google?
Oh, that hurts.
I'm sorry. I promised I wouldn't make you laugh.
According to Gizmodo, in the early 1990s, there were about 20 different search engines to choose from, including WebCrawler, Lycos, AltaVista, and Yandex. Similar to library catalogs, these search engine indexes were compiled and organized by topic, content, structure, and subject.